Hello, and welcome to French Tech News with Chris O'Brien and Ethan Pierce, an audio and video podcast and clubhouse series highlighting important stories in English in the world of France's startups, its entrepreneurs, investors, and ecosystem leaders. Our objective is to continue to open this incredible ecosystem up to the Anglophone startup and investment community worldwide. And speaking of the podcast, head on over to Apple or Spotify and search for French Tech News and give that a subscribe. There you will find all of our past discussions and interviews. Today on French Tech News, our guest is Nicolas Brusson, co-founder and CEO at BlaBlaCar, the world's leading inner-city ride-sharing service. We'll be discussing carpooling in the pandemic, post-pandemic world, lessons in international growth, especially of BlaBlaCar's bus service in markets like Mexico, India, Russia, and Brazil, the road to becoming the inner-city transportation super app, and building a culture of entrepreneurship and legacy through the BlaBlaCar mafia. Welcome, Nicolas.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And welcome to my partner in this French Tech News journey, Chris O'Brien.
Great to be here. Well, Nicolas, it's great to see you again. Thanks for taking time with us. You know, I've followed the BlaBlaCar journey not as long as you, obviously, but the past 7 years I've been in France. So actually, I thought it would be great to start with the recent news, which was sort of big and surprising with your funding. Tell me a little bit about that latest funding announcement, you know, why you guys are raising money again and what that says about where you guys are in your own journey.
Yeah, I mean, I think the story is the stress test that the pandemic has caused on the world of transport and travel in general and what it meant for different companies. And if you look at that from in absolute term, you have the whole travel business, the whole transport businesses have essentially reduced in size during the pandemic because less and less people traveled, at least last year. We see the same actually early this year. So what's interesting is to see like who are the winners and losers of this sort of like massive shock on this industry. And I think we start to understand that just right now, and we'll probably see that in the years to come. And what we see is the, like we said, the novel marketplace type mode of transport have done a lot better than the more classic mode of transport. So maybe I'll start with an analogy that people might understand better than BlaBlaCar, actually, especially on a global scale. If you look at accommodations and what happened to the broad world of accommodation with the like of Airbnb and Booking.com and all the hotel group, it's pretty obvious that post-pandemic, the reinforced winner is Airbnb, right? And if you think of like, why is Airbnb doing better? Why is Airbnb worth so much and had such a fantastic IPO back end of 2020? Well, it really comes from the agility of the model, where during this crisis, Airbnb has been able to adapt its supply to a new type of demand. So people were not necessarily looking for apartment in the middle of New York City or in the middle of Paris. They were probably looking for other places in the countryside, or if you think of France, maybe they were going more to Brittany, to the coast, to, again, like maybe the countryside. And the marketplace adapted to that, right? The supply adapted to that new demand, and they've done better than any hotel brand. They've done better than any hotel OTA because they represent those hotel brands. And they've done better because it's based on collective intelligence. Same thing really applies to BlaBlaCar, right? If you think of it, our network is not based on us deciding that we put trains or planes or buses on specific route at specific time and that we sort of guessed where people are going to go. For the most part, when you think of the carpooling side of the business, which is the dominant part of the business and the DNA of the business, it's based on collective intelligence. So, if we look at the current situation today, like what's going to happen in May and June and during the summer in France or in Spain, we don't know. And we don't need to know because essentially our network is going to rebuild itself, both in terms of volume and where people go in terms of destinations, real time, right? So it's part of this like C2C marketplace or collective intelligence of the more sharing economy platform. So now, if you take a step back and you analyze the numbers in 2020, we actually dropped about 30%, right, between 2019 and and 2020. So we were doing about 70 million passengers in 2019. We went down to 50 in 2020. And if you compare that to any transport platform, whether it's the like of Trainline or Expedia, or if you look at hotels with Booking.com, they all dropped between 50 and 80% between 19 and 20, right? So essentially, we dropped a lot less in terms of like people actually using our platform during the pandemic. So you know, it puts us in a very interesting position, because as things start to reopen, so we are, touch wood, you know, at the beginning of a reopening in Europe, in some markets like the US and the UK, it has already reopened and we see that people are traveling again. You know, we feel we are in a very, very good position to not just recover, but actually to continue to gain market share. Because to some extent, we gained market share in 2020. We gained market share in 2021 in pretty much all of the 22 markets where we operate. And we don't want to just preserve that. We want to accelerate. And that's part of this funding, is to be to be on in a more offensive mode, I would say, in several markets, by reinvesting early, by continuing to grab market share, and possibly being acquisitive. So essentially, it's not about like raising money to, I would say, lick our wounds from the crisis. It's rather an offensive play of raising money to expand faster in some market, and to some extent, sort of like consolidate the market share gain we had during the pandemic, which is very hard to see and read, because it happened in a very bizarre period where the entire tide was going down, but actually we went down a lot less than any other mode of transport.
And so then, to follow that thought, well, two questions really. More concretely, what is that becoming more offensive, more aggressive? What does that look like? Is it about marketing, hiring people? And in terms of the agility you described, I think that's super interesting to think about. I certainly don't want to reduce the work that you do personally, but does that adjustment sort of almost happen automatically at this point in terms of the way the system adapts at moments like this? Or is it not automatic, and there's you guys are scrambling to sort of help it adapt?
Yeah, no, I'd love to say we're incredibly smart about predicting, you know, what's going to happen on the platform, but it's fairly automatic, is the truth, right? So our job is rather to create trust in the community and to enable matching as well as possible. So essentially, like, our job would be, as a driver, if you propose a specific route in the country, it's to be really smart about matching you with passengers, not just between the start point and your end point as a driver, but any point along the route. Calculate like your pickup and drop off along the way, calculate smart prices of this subsegment, so that essentially we increase or we maximize the matching between passengers and drivers. That's what we do. Now, knowing where people would go, are they going to do more or less cross-border? Are they going to be concentrated on top routes like, you know, Paris to Lyon, for example, in France? Or are they going to go to like more granular countryside type routes? We don't decide. What's the volume? We don't really decide, right? We can influence that, I would say, by, you know, pushing with more marketing. But the truth is like 90% is, you know, people powered and based on collective intelligence. To take an extreme example of that, there are markets like India, Mexico, Turkey, where today we have no team on the ground. So it's a centralized product. We operate from Paris. And we have not spent a single dollar in marketing for the last 3 years. Right. So, and those markets were growing roughly 80-100% year on year pre-COVID. We had to shut down the platform. India is a good example. We had to shut down the platform legally, right, during the first phase of the COVID crisis. So essentially, there was no one on the platform mechanically because we had to shut down the platform. We reopened the platform. We've done zero marketing, so zero marketing spend. Again, no team on the ground. Things came back, and we see these oscillations based on market condition and restrictions. So to a large extent, that's we are not a transport company. We are not network planners. We essentially, we end up more being like a trust broker and a matching algorithm just to make sure we create the conditions in the product so that people can match.
If people have used BlaBlaCar, the car version where I'm going somewhere and I want to have some people come in the car with me, share expenses. But busing is actually a big part of what you're doing now as well. How does that work? Because you're saying you're not a centralized, you know, provider of that. So is that people who actually, is that local transport companies that are using BlaBlaCar to fill their buses? Or what does that look like? And is that a French product only or is that elsewhere?
No, it's mostly elsewhere, actually. So I'll get to the French product because the French product of on buses is actually the exception. It's not the rule. So I'll explain that in a minute and what we do outside of Western Europe. But maybe to take a step back, like what we realized roughly a couple of years ago is that with carpooling, we create like a very strong sense of community. We have lots of people using the platform, very strong brand, and people keep on coming back. But they only come back and they only come and visit BlaBlaCar for one very specific mode of transport, which is very unique. And in a way, I would not say we created because you don't create carpooling, but we're known for, which is long distance carpooling. And we realized that we miss out on all the rest. So in a way, we have this community of people traveling and we don't offer rail, we don't offer buses, we don't try to combine those modes of transport together to build like a bigger network. And we quickly thought that does not make sense. Like, at some point, we should also expand into other mode of transport and essentially offer more to this very strong and very specific demand that we created of close to 100 million people actually signed up on a global scale. The natural expansion for us are buses, right? Because if you think of it, it's also on the road. It's something you would arbitrate pretty naturally with taking a BlaBlaCar, is taking a bus. It's fairly low cost as well. So we went into that, and the way we went into the bus market, we are going after the bus market, is again, but what we do best, meaning technology and connecting bus carriers to the platform. So if you look at the way we do that in Brazil, in Russia, Ukraine, and Poland, essentially we connect 1,000, literally, of bus operators. So those are small or large regional bus operators, typically doing like routes of 50 to 1,000 kilometer. And essentially, we provide the software to enable them to distribute the tickets online. So think of that as booking.com for buses in those markets, or to be more precise, it would be a mix of a GDS, a la Amadeus, combined with a booking.com or an Expedia on the ticketing side to distribute them. And I insist on the first part because actually what we realized in those markets, it's not as simple as taking an API for some of these small companies in the eastern part of Russia. You need to provide the entire software stack to help them digitalize something that today is sold almost 100% offline. So that's what we've been doing. And essentially by doing that, we end up offering mini seats in cars, which is carpooling, which is the DNA of the company, but also seats in buses. And in 2022, we'll start to integrate train. And we start combining those trips together so that you can book like a train journey combined with a carpool, maybe for the last, 50 miles or whatnot. So that's what we're doing mostly outside of Europe. We have a slightly different model in Europe. Same goal. It's just to offer buses and train and carpool on a single platform and to become this sort of like single one app for terrestrial transport in those countries. In Europe, because the bus market is not fragmented and was recently liberalized in markets like Germany, Italy, and France, we end up being what I would call like a virtual operator in a sense that we don't own the buses, we don't hire the bus drivers, and we rely on transporters to do that because they do that job much, much better than we do. But we end up contracting the entire bus, branding the bus, pricing every seat on the bus and guaranteeing the distribution of 100% of that bus inventory. So that's why you see those branded buses, those BlaBlaCar buses running in France, cross border. We have some in Germany and going essentially to Italy, Spain, and even to the UK, for instance. So slightly different business model in the sense that the Europe is more of the exception where actually we become a quasi-operator of those buses. At least from a sales point of view, sales and marketing point of view. But the broader model we deploy everywhere else in the world is purely a technology marketplace model. Like, we connect with the existing and very large, by the way, inventory of buses in those markets.
That's great. Thank you.
Do you see then Flix or Flixbus as one of your direct competitors? I mean, I know they came a little bit at that from the bus side of it originally. I mean, are they essentially now a direct competitor? I think they've added a little bit of carpooling or had talked about that at some point.
I mean, they are one of the, I would say one of the competitor, mostly on what I just mentioned, mostly on the virtually operated bus business in Europe, because they operate exactly the same model. So in that sense, like the BlaBlaCar bus model and the FlixBus model are, I mean, very similar or identical if you just look at the way we operate the bus in Europe. Now, on the carpool side, not really, because what we see is, it's going to sound interesting, but BlaBlaCar buses don't really compete with carpooling. Like, what we see in countries like France and Spain and Germany is that BlaBlaCar tends to be very good to connect points on the map that don't have a bus station or don't have a train station. So if you look at carpooling, it's about 200,000 just in France, right? It's 200,000 pickup and drop off destinations. And they tend to be in the suburbs, they tend to be in small villages. So they tend to connect points that are not which are not convenient to connect with a train or a bus, right? So our buses in Europe tend to compete indeed with FlixBus. The rest of the activity, whether it's carpooling in Europe or outside of Europe, doesn't. And then we tend to have local competition, which tends to be, so if you look at the company we acquired, for example, in Russia, a company called Bus4. Bus4 was a bus OTA. So they had built like a good technology platform to connect buses onto their platform. But the thing they were lacking was brand and consumer awareness. So they had to build demand. And what we had done with BlaBlaCar is we have built this fantastic brand where people, as I said, people come back to the platform, they look for trips. And as we combine Bus4 with BlaBlaCar, essentially we combine all the work they've done from a technology standpoint, like connecting buses to a platform and digitalizing that bus offer, to a massive pool of demand looking for trips. And as we connected the two, we fill up the buses a lot faster than a traditional OTA. So in most emerging market, I would say competition is sometimes some local OTA, but they tend to have we tend to have superior unit economics because, again, we have that that free demand. But the truth is, if we take a step back, I would say we sort of fighting is not the right word, but we're fighting two things. One is convincing more people to share their car, and that's that's fundamentally one of the biggest growth hurdles that we tackle with carpooling. It's how do you make it compelling increasingly for drivers to share their car, and not just now and then, just to share their car almost all the time. And that's why we launched BlaBlaCar Daily to try to crack that sort of commuter segment where people will start to share their car when they go to work and as often as possible. So that's one of the, I would say, enemy or growth ceiling, I would say, we need to crack is how do you convince people to share their car more and how do you combat people alone in their car? And number two, specifically outside of Europe, it's all about the offline to online shift of people booking buses, which is just going to happen. So today, when we look at countries like Russia and Brazil where we operate, those are multi-billion dollar bus markets. And interestingly, it has not yet in those markets went online. So it's it's like booking airline tickets 20 years ago, pre-Expedia or pre-booking.com. It has not yet happened. And it turns out that with BlaBlaCar in those markets, we end up being the natural platform to do that because thanks to carpooling that in a way we sort of created ourselves, we have more demand than any other digital platform for ticketing of those buses. So as we connect them, we end up being the Expedia of buses, or again, booking.com of buses for comparison in those markets. So I would say those are the two things we tend to worry about. And not that we don't worry about competition. You always have competition, but I would say that's not the biggest driving force of how big BlaBlaCar is going to be and how fast we're going to get to our growth objective. those are the two things essentially that will define the speed of growth for us more than competition, I would think.
That's interesting because, of course, you know, in France, we think of BlaBlaCar as kind of being, not an old company, but you've been around for officially, I guess, more than a decade at this point. And yet, you know, the dynamic you're describing, it really sounds like you're still just tapping into this larger potential, especially on the global basis in some of these markets you're talking about. I mean, and I guess that's where, you know, thinking about where the company's going, if I remember reading correctly, you know, you guys had talked about you think you'll get to profitability. I think there's still talk of an IPO. I mean, is that how you view the opportunity in front of you, though?
Yeah, I mean, so maybe a couple of things to unpick from what you said. I mean, first of all, there is a transformation of BlaBlaCar that has not always been perceived, actually, if you look at that from the French side. So maybe to give you a sense and put some rough numbers on that transformation, in 2015, 3/4 of BlaBlaCar usage was in France, right? So it was mostly not just a French company, it was mostly French users. And we had started this international expansion, but it was less than a quarter of the company in terms of usage. Today, that's 80% of usage is outside of France. 60% of usage is outside of Europe, right? So that's how international we've become. And I would say that's also how, in terms of usage, non-European we've become. And essentially what it means is, you know, the countries carrying by far the biggest growth for us is this collection of emerging markets. It's Russia, Ukraine, Brazil, Mexico, India, Turkey. So as the sum of all of that has outgrown and will continue to outgrow Europe. So it's true that if you look at that from a European or a French prism, you might get like the wrong image, you know, of the company because, you know, it has grown in France, but in France we've been mostly rolling out and demonstrating the business model, right? So it became like France is a highly profitable country for us. Same is Spain, but most of that was reinvested in other European countries and mostly outside of Europe. Growth. Now, when it comes to the financing and the next financing and an IPO, we always said that the goal, ideally, I mean, you know, you don't control 100% of that, but the goal was to stay independent. And to some extent, like, you staying independent as a company means at some point you should become, I mean, most likely you become a public company. So it's not totally new. In terms of timing for us, I mean, the way we think of it is, it's not so much like, you know, are we preparing an IPO today? No, we're not preparing an IPO for tomorrow, for the next month or so. Does it feel like the logical next step? And does it feel like, you know, we should get ready for an IPO, you know, over the next 12, 18, 24 months, and you never control those windows? Yes, it would make sense for a BlaBlaCar to at least be IPO ready. In terms of internal processes and the way we work and the board and the governance and the ESG. The different pillars of ESG and the different compliance aspect, and not just compliance, even just like you projecting that what we do a bit better to future shareholder is something we need to prepare for. On top of that, from a business standpoint, you're going back to what I described at the beginning, the crisis probably accelerated the delta between the very light sort of people powered network that we are and the traditional network. So we feel that, you know, as things reopen, touch wood, back end of 2021 and in 2022, we should see, given the business model, a lot of operating leverage. So essentially what that means is our cost is not going to double or triple or explode actually in the next year. We keep on investing in engineers, but we've always done that. But as the demand comes back, you should see your usage, you should see your revenue kicking back in, and we should be in a path to be profitable by, we'll see how aggressive we want to be in terms of expansion and acquisition, but, you know, by 2022 or back end of 2022, we should be at least demonstrating very strong operating leverage, which would put us in a reasonable position to go IPO at that time. noted that it's not even a requirement today. Huh? You see lots of companies going IPO without having demonstrated profitability and doing very well. Airbnb being a prime example in our space.
It was making me think while you were talking about the international expansion. I think the very first conversation I had with you was, if this feels like 100 years ago now, but it was at one of the web summits. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think you guys had just raised a big round that kind of kicked up your visibility internationally in terms of, you know, the ecosystem felt very young. And here was this company that people in Silicon Valley maybe hadn't heard of and just raised this sort of record-setting round. And that was your focus at the time, that you, I think you were going to drive that international expansion beyond some of the European core markets that BlaBlaCar had already been successful. And it's been interesting following that, because all the things you're describing, it also hasn't been a straightforward journey. You know, you had places you entered the market and were enormously successful. I think of, you know, Russia probably being in that category. You had other places that you went into. It didn't work. I think you came out, or you maybe went back in with a different strategy. So, you know, I'm wondering now that things seem to be really, I don't want to say they're easy or you know, simple for you at this point.
Yeah.
But it sounds like you guys have learned a lot about how to approach all these different markets, because all the dynamics you're describing, you know, trust, getting people to share their cars, branding, that's got to be very distinct. You know, there's not a one size fit all to those questions.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, because going back to that discussion we probably had, I think it was in 2015, that's when we've done the big round. So that's like, you know, 6 years ago, give or take. It's true that we were at the beginning, or we had just started that international journey. And yeah, it's not been a walk in the park in a sense. And, you know, and it feels pretty obvious to say that. Like, you know, we launched within 2 or 3 years, we launched countries like Russia, Ukraine, India, Turkey, Mexico, Brazil. We've done several M&A to get to that. So as you do that, you make mistakes, right? And we've made mistakes. And I often describe it this way. I think the mistake we have not done was launching those countries and following that strategy. Because if I look at where we are today, again, the biggest value is the fact that almost all those countries are growing. They just took like a very unexpected path where we maybe overhired, overspent, and then we had to cut back. And then actually we realized, like, India and Mexico, as I said, like, growing with no team and zero marketing on the ground. And still it's doing very, very well. So it's been like a non-linear journey. I'm sure there was like a more efficient way and a faster way to do it. But the thing I'm left with is, you know, I had no doubt that taking that long journey of building a global play was the right thing, because today, and especially after a crisis like that, the fact that we are in those 22 countries, that they behaved in different ways, it just created like a world. I mean, it is creating a lot of opportunities right now. The fact that suddenly we expand into that bus business, we didn't think about that like 5 years ago. Yeah, I'd be lying if I said like, hey, Chris, I knew that we would become this like one-stop shop, multimodal app in Russia or in Brazil. We had no clue. I mean, we're just building a community around carpooling. And then from that, you realize that, well, actually, you can almost start to do what you were seen to disrupt, i.e. traditional transport, and help them become digital. And today, like, we realize that that's a massive play in those markets, because you can play a fundamental role in this offline to online transformation. But it comes from, you know, maybe taking a step back, it comes from this optionality you create by being global, by being in several markets. Now, is there a cost to that optionality? Yeah, always. Options are not free. So the cost was we had to finance it, and it's harder work. It's more complex. But at the end, I mean, I hope that, you know, a few years down the road, we would have created a business that you could have never created if we had stayed in France or a couple of markets in Europe. It's just a longer journey. I think people need to acknowledge that it takes more time. It's going to take more capital. But fundamentally, I believe it's worth it in terms of like entrepreneurial journey. And even from an investor standpoint, I would say the return you get by, you know, having this collection of options over time actually superior than being a single country actor, where actually the risk is you become subscale, and then it becomes like a downward spiral, because you either you get acquired, or even worse, sometimes you end up in a complete downward spiral because you cannot invest enough, you don't have enough engineers, you subscale in many ways, and you become irrelevant over time. So looking back, I lots of mistakes, but directionally, I guess this global journey was the right one, and it still is.
So when we talk to Lydia, they are on their way to becoming the fintech super app. Alan is on its way to becoming the insurance super app. So it sounds like BlaBlaCar is not far from becoming the carpooling and ride sharing super app. Looks like you're well on your way.
I hope so. Yeah, I would say the way to present it, it's maybe not so much like the ride sharing or carpooling super app. I guess the vision is a bit broader, where we want to become the app in several markets that you open when you think of going from A to B intercity, right? So today, if you look at the battle in cities, it's well fought, right? So you have Uber, obviously, you have many other like Lyft in the US. So essentially, like trying to connect not just the ride sharing app like Uber, but you're trying to connect like e-scooters and bikes and so on. There's probably going to be one or two winners of the in-city super app, like for transport. Today, if you look at intercity, it's not there yet. You know, there is not much for intercity. There's something for flight, or there are different apps or websites, whether it's Expedia or others, Kayak or whatnot, if you think of flights. But if you think of like the best way to book like a carpool or a bus or a train, it varies country by country. Or it's non-existent in some countries. Again, like if I think of emerging markets, it's simply non-existent. It's to be done, right? So that's what we want to become. And I think there is like a category leader to be defined. And again, like I think in a surprising way, we'll end up, I hope, we'll end up being the app you think about to book a bus, and maybe in some countries to book a train, or to combine a train with a bus and a carpool. Because we started with something unique, and this unique thing is the car and carpooling, which create a strong sense of community, which is like a completely uncapped inventory, in a sense that there are a lot more seats available in cars than any other means of transport in any country. But again, I think it gives us like a fundamental advantage. The same way, there's a parallel to Airbnb again, like the same way Airbnb now is doing short-term rental, they're going to do boutique hotel, and they're going to expand into that market. And why are they likely going to win actually in this market? It's because they have something people don't have. They have these like apartments, they have this C2C component, and they have the house in the tree, that they show on the app. That makes them special. And the fact that they have this unique inventory, it drives demand, brand love to your app. And from that, you can build bigger and bigger things. So the vision is not so much to become like the app of carpooling. I would say on carpooling, we already the app of carpooling in several markets, where we have like over 10 million members in France, in Russia, close to that in Spain or other countries. It's really becoming this transport app for intercity that's not quite there yet.
Well, I think there's a couple interesting things I take away from this, One, I like this. So often for young entrepreneurs, I think they feel that pressure that growth has got to be steady and dramatic. And I think when they're confronted by those moments that things are not going as planned, you hear the stories about either a radical pivot or just they abandon the project. And you guys have really just continued to push and refine on that original vision, I think, that you've always had there. And the other thing, of course, and you probably get sick of people asking you about this, but the conventional wisdom is today, and I hear this all the time, is you've got to be in the United States to really build a global company. And of course, all the stuff you're describing, you guys have managed to build a global company, a global brand, without needing that market in the U.S. to get you to that level of revenue and customers. And so I think for you know, just a good example, there's all these other markets out there for entrepreneurs to pursue.
Yeah, no, that's right. And I think not being in the US, or rather the US not having a good product market fit for what we were doing originally, which is carpooling, it's been a plus and a minus. It's been a minus in the early days, in a sense that people had a hard time to believe BlaBlaCar would fly initially, because they thought that no one has done that in the US. And, you know, like back like 6, 7, 8 years ago, still a bit today, but I think less so, for many VCs, like, you know, Europe was doing stuff that had been seen in the US. And essentially, it was about, like, you know, skating like a year later in Europe on things that had been done in the US. Again, I think the mindset has changed, but back then it was very, very anchored. And many, many times in the early days of BlaBlaCar, we've heard that what you do is not going to work. Like, there is no US equivalent to that. And why would that work in Europe? Then it's been, in a way, an advantage, because we had no US gorilla, right? So suddenly, like, you, we ended up being, at least on, let's call that our niche, to be humble, because it's not, you know, we're not an Airbnb or Stripe by any stretch, but in that niche, we became the leader. So yeah, we became, like, today, like, we're number one in Brazil, we're number one in Germany, we're number one in France, we're number one in Russia. I mean, we've become that dominant force on long distance carpooling. Would it make sense, you know, as the product evolve into this broader marketplace where we start to integrate train and buses, and we launch like BlaBlaCar Daily, which is more of this commuter app, which might make more sense for the US? You know, there might be a point, it's not on the radar, short-term radar, but there might be a point where you open in the US. And it's true that the thing you don't get by not being in the US is sort of like this, you know, I would say, corporate press or investor visibility that you get. I mean, you tend to get, that gets overblown when you are in the US versus not. But, you know, beyond that, is it possible to build a global company without being in the US? Yeah, it is. I think you need a good reason. Like, if there is a good product market in the US, for sure you should go in the US. You'll get visibility. You'll get, like, access to lots of investors, maybe a lot faster. But, you know, can you build, like, a good global company on something that does not have, like, a fundamental product market fit in the US? Yes, of course. And you know, it's been done in other emerging markets specifically, actually.
Great. Well, Nicola, that's most of my questions. Ethan, do you have anything else on your agenda for Nicola?
We might not have time, but there's always the discussion about the BlaBlaCar Mafia. You guys have built something amazing, and now people are building other amazing things. So.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually, because that's probably one of the things we're the most proud of, actually. It's the fact that it's something I joked about in the early days of BlaBlaCar, because I spent 7 years in the Valley as working for startups from 1999 to 2006, and then I worked as a VC for a while before BlaBlaCar. So I had seen the strength of the Silicon Valley ecosystem. I had heard and seen, to some extent, the PayPal Mafia. All the great thing that came out of that. I also saw, like, back in the late 90s, early 20s, like, you know, how people that worked at Fairchild Semiconductor started Intel, who started Kleiner Perkins, who funded all these great companies. And you realize that, you know, there is sort of a waterfall of great talent. And we joked about that in the early days of BlaBlaCar, where I was telling to the employees that, you know, BlaBlaCar is a place where you come, you learn, you get equity. So if things go well, actually, you probably make money out of equity. And the only thing we ask you in return is, when you leave, do something great and build a great legacy out of this company. And obviously, in the early days, you don't see that. It takes time to materialize. And now, almost 10 years later, I think the first wave of employees we hired in 12, 13, so it's been like 8, 9 years now. Some people have left, and we have, like, these fantastic cohorts of, you know, like, young entrepreneurs that started their company. They start to fundraise, and I'm losing track of how much has been raised actually by the BlaBla Mafia. But, you know, we're extremely proud of that, and it shows that yes, you need to invest in that logic. And by the way, that's the best thing that can happen to a company, is that your alumni are successful. Because it's the best hiring message you can give. It's like, look, people who came through this company and spend 2, 3, 4 years actually are doing great things. So it's a fantastic learning experience. So we keep on tracking that and communicating on that and trying to help each other as BlaBlaCar alumni. And I think it's a very positive sign of the ecosystem as a whole.
There's a great story with Bill Gates, I believe, where they were in the early days, they were looking at investing in training and spending lots of money on, you know, having this philosophical discussion about enabling their employees. The budget was significant and there was all this, these ideas. And he was challenged with the idea of what happens if we spend all this money enabling and empowering our employees and they leave. And his answer was, what happens if we don't and they stay?
Yeah, no, exactly. So as the philosophy, it should not be taboo and you should form people to become great entrepreneurs and they do great things in your company. And if they leave and they do great things, it feeds back into not just the ecosystem, but your brand. And that's positive.
Yeah, I just try to think back, you know, those few years ago, that must have seemed like such a radical message in France, where it seemed like so much of the work culture is I get a job, I stay in that job, I retire from that job. To have somebody who's saying, oh, welcome, and then please go.
Yeah, no, that's probably why I've done it, by the way, because for me, it was a bit of a reverse cultural shock because I mean, I'm French and I grew up in France, but I actually finished my studies in the US and all I've ever known was Silicon Valley startups in terms of like work environment. And then I worked as a VC and it was, you're based in London, mostly investing. Actually, we invested a lot in the US, Israel, Sweden, which are more entrepreneurial in spirit than France by a long shot, especially back then. And when I came back and I was hiring for BlaBlaCar, I was surprised that we had like great talents. But you know, for instance, people, even from the top schools, were not even asking for stock options. Like it was like foreign to them that they should have equity in the company. So I had to do this whole education on what we are as an object. Like you essentially like, yeah, I'm not guaranteeing work for life. I'm not guaranteeing like a walk in the park type journey where you're going to progress every year and your salary is going to go up. It's just an adventure. And we hope it's going to be a positive adventure. You have a piece of the cake. And I hope you're going to learn a lot. And you might stay for 2, 3, 4, 5, 8, 10 years, who knows. And you might go and do something else, and that's okay, and that's great, and we'll encourage that. I mean, not you to leave, but we'll encourage that. You know, if you get bored, if you think the next gig is outside, then that's fine. And yes, so I had to sort of like maybe over communicate on that because the ecosystem back then and still today to some extent was very mature about startups and what we are as again as an object, which is a bit different from a mature company or a state-owned company for that matter.
Yeah, well, I think that's great. And it's certainly, I think, making an impact and a message that's been heard. So I think it's great to see and hear that spirit here.
Well, thank you, Nicholas, for taking the time to be with us today. It was a fantastic conversation and super excited to hear that things are going well and are going to go incredibly well as things open up for BlaBlaCar over the next couple months and year as we get back to life.
We hope so.
Thank you, Chris, as always. Thank you to our listeners for joining us for this episode of the French Tech News. Want more news and stories from France's incredible innovation ecosystem and its entrepreneurs? Subscribe to the French Tech News with Chris and Ethan on Apple Podcasts and Spotify and switch on notifications to be informed of new episodes as soon as they are released. You can connect with Chris and me on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Clubhouse. I am at Ethan Pierce, that's E-T-H-A-N-P-I-E-R-S-E, and Chris O'Brien is at O'Brien, O-B-R-I-E-N. Let us know if there are guests that you would like to see on the interview podcast or Clubhouse, as well as any stories that we should take a look at. As always, thank you for listening, and see you next time.